You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
the future of Iraq depends primarily on the ability of Iraq's leaders to come together and take a stand united against ISIL. Not next week, not next month, but now.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry offers the rapidly unraveling Iraq all support short of actual help. Former British diplomat John Everard and author and historian Justin Marozzi will join me to discuss that story and the other big news of today. Then...
Ya no quiero viajar ya con ese indio.
Nos vamos a ir los tres, ¿entendiste, verdad? Los tres, así que te aguantas.
Film director Diego Camarda Diaz will be here to discuss his much garlanded debut feature, The Golden Dream, newly released in the UK. Plus, Sue Stewart will review the week's world music releases, and Monocle's man in Madrid, Liam Aldous, will run through the day's news from Spain. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead, as ever, but before all that, Suzanne Chislett has the latest news.
The US Secretary of State says regional unity will be key to expel ISIS rebels from Iraq. John Kerry is meeting with Kurdish leaders and has urged them to back Baghdad as it tries to force Islamist militants out. Monocle's Rebecca Collard is in the Kurdish city of Erbil and says politicians there want to separate from Baghdad, not increase ties.
They don't want a new deal with Baghdad. They want autonomy. They want sovereignty. But, you know, of course, that requires the international community. They can't have a country that is recognized unless they are able to get people on board with that.
In Iraq, the UN says more than 1,000 people, mainly civilians, have been killed in fighting this month. The government says its forces have now regained control of the big oil refinery at Beji. The Ukrainian government has accused pro-Russian separatists of shooting down an army helicopter. The aircraft was downed near Slavyansk in the east of the country. 9 people were on board and it's feared all may have been killed. The incident came hours after rebels agreed to a week-long ceasefire while peace talks continue. Russian President Vladimir Putin has called for substantive progress to be made. Meanwhile, the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe has confirmed it's again been able to contact 2 groups of its monitors who are being held by separatists in eastern Ukraine. Cathy Burton is a spokesperson for OSCE.
We have now had contact with the monitors who are being held in Ukraine. This is very important for us to know, of course, that they are well. We have had email contact with one group very briefly, and with another group we had telephone contact again very briefly.
The Australian government says it will try again to appeal to authorities in Egypt following the 7-year jail sentences given to 3 Al Jazeera journalists. The Australian reporter and 2 Egyptian colleagues were found guilty of supporting the now banned Muslim Brotherhood. The verdict and sentences have been condemned by governments and civil rights groups around the world, but the president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, said he will not use his power to pardon the man as he doesn't want to interfere in the judicial process. The lawyer of the Sudanese woman who was freed from jail yesterday after refusing to renounce her Christian faith has been rearrested. Mariam Yahya Ibrahim was sentenced to death for apostasy but was released after international pressure. It's claimed that along with her husband and 2 children, she was detained as she tried to board a plane to leave Khartoum. The British Prime Minister has made a public apology after his former spin doctor was convicted of phone hacking. David Cameron has stood by his press secretary, Andy Coulson, when the initial claims were made about voicemail interceptions when he edited the News of the World newspaper. Today, Mr. Coulson's been found guilty of phone hacking. The Prime Minister has said sorry for hiring him.
I take full responsibility for employing Andy Coulson. I did so on the basis of undertakings I was given by him about phone hacking, and those turn out not to be the case. I always said that if they turned out to be wrong, I would make a full and frank apology, and I do that today. I'm extremely sorry that I employed him. It was the wrong decision, and I'm very clear about that.
Rebecca Brooks, the former chief executive of News International, the now closed company run by Rupert Murdoch, was acquitted of all the charges she faced, as were her husband and former personal assistant. And Swedish lawyers for the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange have filed a court petition to withdraw an arrest warrant against him. Mr. Assange has spent the past 2 years living inside Ecuador's embassy in London to avoid extradition to Sweden. He faces allegations of sexual assault and rape there, which he denies. He believes Sweden could try to send him to the United States to be tried for one of the largest leaks of classified information in US history. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Suzanne. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, which makes it 13.06 in New York City. Still Costa Rica, England, nil each, if you're at all interested. I'm not sure England are, to be honest. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is John Everard, the former British ambassador to Pyongyang and author of the memoir Only Beautiful Please, and Justin Marozzi, journalist and historian, most recently author of Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood. Welcome both. We will start in Justin's former bailiwick of Iraq, where things could not be said to be improving, unless perhaps you're a member of ISIS. The Urgents now claim to control Iraq's principal oil refinery at Baiji. The Kurds are being increasingly unambiguous about their desire to be shot of the rest of the country. And the outside world's most coherent response so far has been to send a man who was once outwitted by George W. Bush. Justin, John Kerry is saying there is no military solution. That sounds like a sentence that needs to be finished, perhaps with something like, that we want anything to do with. Is there?
I think he's quite right. How long is it going to take us to learn that military intervention, especially when it's Western-led, doesn't particularly work in the Middle East? The solution to this terrible crisis in Iraq has got to come from Iraqi's leaders, and we know they're incredibly fractured. We've heard the statements from the Kurdish community today that this looks like an auspicious time for independence. Sunnis raging against Shia. I'm not sure how much drone strikes or special forces can do beyond acting as a sort of brief plaster to a sort of suppurating wound.
You talk there, Justin, about how a solution has to come from Iraqi's leaders. If I was in a position where I was waiting for a solution from Iraqi's leaders, I think I would be spending rather a lot of money on tinned goods and ammunition. They're not terribly inspiring or competent people, are they?
That's a very fair point, Andrew. I think Maliki has been a really dismal failure for Iraqis, and I was in touch with some Iraqis today who are just saying they feel they've got really no hope for the future. Some are making plans to head further south. Equally, though, there is a strong feeling in Baghdad that ISIS is not going to take Baghdad. And to quote an Iraqi friend of mine who I spoke to a little bit earlier, he said the Shia will eat them alive. You know, they're not going to take over the capital. Nevertheless, that leaves a huge amount of territory in ISIS hands. As you said, if you rely solely on Iraqi leaders, that's unlikely to shift anytime soon. But there is also considerable pressure on Maliki, possibly to leave, certainly to sort of rally around and get the Sunnis and Kurds on board. I don't have great faith in him being able to do that personally.
John Everard, a veteran of diplomacy and possibly tricky situations, is there a situation like this in which there is a fairly obviously live, vigorous and somewhat difficult to comprehend war occurring? Is there a role for diplomacy while facts on the ground are still not entirely established?
Yes, I think there is a role for diplomacy even at this early stage and even while emotions, as you rightly say, run high. Not least, I think that it's important to actually establish what everybody's aims are in all this. What is it actually that ISIS wants? I mean, their statements so far have been less than clear. I think also there's a role for diplomacy actually outside Iraq. And I think the time has come to ask the question that everybody's been avoiding for so long. Just how much does it matter if Iraq breaks up? Are we actually going to be better off with the state split into constituent parts, which may be a little more stable than the assembled whole?
Justin, put the same question to you, and this is, you know, we're far from the first people this has occurred to. With the Kurdish president Masoud Barzani has said Iraq is obviously falling apart, which is about as undiplomatic as a speech as you could possibly get from somebody in his position. Is a breakup of Iraq manageable?
Well, I think any such breakup is going to be extremely bloody. But then at the moment, keeping the existing borders looks, the whole country is swimming in blood already. I mean, I think we probably should remember as well that this territory that we now call Iraq, not long ago, consisted of three Ottoman provinces, Mosul in the north, Baghdad in the center, and Basra in the south. And largely that reflects Shia in the south, Sunni in the middle sandwich, and up in the north, the Kurds. So it is quite conceivable that the country could split up peacefully. I think very difficult to predict that. You'd have great regional rivalries. The West certainly has strong interest in there. At the moment, we're sort of trying to preserve the integrity of the state. I think a split up, if it happens, could inject, more chaos into the region as well.
It is depressingly likely that it would be rather more akin to the breakup of Yugoslavia than the breakup of Czechoslovakia.
I think a lot of Iraqis will tell you these days, slightly ruefully as well, a lot of them who had been in favor of the US-led intervention in 2003, we were better off under Saddam. We don't like this democracy. If a democracy means if I go off to the market to buy fruit and vegetables for my family, I run the risk of being blown up by a car bomber. I don't want any of it. If we kept our noses clean, we managed to survive under Saddam. This is not a life for us. I think that view is reflected by many Iraqis today.
It's been a long time since I've been in Iraq, nearly 10 years, in fact. But I do remember hearing much the same thing. People do, by and large, have a preference for certainty.
Well, and a leader who can keep a lid on a notoriously unruly country. I mean, Iraq probably is one of the hardest countries to run. Maliki has just conspicuously failed to be an inclusive leader who has got the Sunnis and the Kurds alongside him. Instead of having a sort of Sunni defense minister, which until recently was the norm, he's taken the national security, the interior, and the defense portfolio. So I think a lot of this blame can be laid at his door.
John, you were talking there about the role of diplomacy, and I wanted to sort of link that to what Justin was saying about how there's always a certain suspicion in the Middle East about any intervention, military or otherwise, if it's led by what they think of as the West, about whom they have certain suspicions, not always without foundation, particularly pertaining to the British and the United States. Is this a realm in which anything that Britain or America even attempts is just going to make things worse?
No, I don't think it's quite that bad. But you're right, there are acute sensitivities. And anybody who's got previous, shall we say, in Iraq is going to have to tread very carefully. You have to ask yourself also, if not the United States and the United Kingdom, then who else? I mean, the Iranians, of course, have got a rather complex, shall we say, relationship with various Iraqi groups. I don't think that they will be seen as honest brokers. The French are kind of out of it. Are you going to go to the Russians and the Chinese? There aren't many faces around right now with whom all Iraqis are going to be comfortable.
I mean, and sort of looking at this as a professional diplomat, what do you think of the predicament that John Kerry finds himself in, and how do you think he's handling it? Because this does appear to be one of those things, and I do think it's strange that so few people seem to get their heads around this, that there are quite often in politics, there just isn't a good option. There isn't an appealing way forward. And John Kerry, at the moment, just looks to me like a man with a whole bunch of rotten options to pick from.
Yes, absolutely. He's looking for least bad options, and he's not going to find a solution to this problem. I mean, let's be clear about that from the outset. What he is trying to do is to apply sticking plaster so that the situation holds together just a little bit longer and gives everybody time to try and thrash out some kind of solution. If he achieves that, that alone would be quite something. But to ask more than that of him, I think, would be unreasonable.
I mentioned there earlier Kurdish President Masoud Barzani, who sounds increasingly like a man, sort of like trying to time his declaration of independence. John Kerry, again, while in Iraq, said, Justin, I wanted to put this thought of Kerry's to you. He said, the rest of Iraq should look like Kurdistan. Why doesn't it?
Well, of course it should, and that's a good point. I mean, I suppose you could say that the no-fly zone imposed a couple of decades ago was an enormous help and fillip for the Kurds to set up what we would call, you know, a decent enough Middle Eastern democracy. So they've had a head start on the rest of Iraq, which was, you know, maintained under the thumb by Saddam. I think, you know, the recent, well, the 20th century, if you look, scroll through the list of Iraqi leaders, it's pretty hard to find a single one who's really governed in the national interest. It's more a case of sort of winner takes all. And I think the Kurds have managed to maintain unity that has just proved much more elusive almost entirely in the south and the center of Baghdad and across the country, where you have this much more deep-seated sectarian conflict, which, even though Iraqis may deny to you today, is very much part and fueling this current crisis.
But the Kurds are not without a history of schism, though. They fought something very akin to a civil war among themselves as recently as the 90s. Why was it that when Saddam was removed, they managed to keep together and get with the program in a way that the rest of Iraq was unable or unwilling to?
I suppose, in a way, that the on the one hand, they had the example of a very brutal dictatorship further to the south that they themselves had suffered grievously, as we all know, at Halabja and elsewhere. That probably served as a serious incentive to maintain a sort of viable, sustainable state. They've managed to attract foreign investment. It has its limitations as a democracy as well, but they have managed, I suppose, against, you know, quite serious odds, to establish a fledgling state. And I think they've been extremely patient. And increasingly, I think there'll be Kurds up in the mountains of northern Iraq who think this is our time now.
OK, well, I think it's depressingly likely we're going to have plenty of opportunity to come back to Iraq over the next days, weeks, and probably decades. Right now, though, we're going to rewind a bit on John Kerry's current triumphant tour of the Middle East. On Sunday, he was in Cairo meeting with President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to congratulate him on having the courtesy to stage an election to confirm his coup d'etat and to promise him large sacks of cash and Apache attack helicopters. On Monday, miracle of timing, a Cairo court sentenced three Al Jazeera journalists to lengthy prison sentences on an assortment of entirely preposterous charges. John Everard, first of all, have we, where the West and Egypt are concerned, have we returned to that old Roosevelt-Somoza dictum that he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch?
There's a certain amount of that around, isn't there?
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe that the timing of the verdicts was entirely coincidental. It may well be that our son of a bitch is nevertheless putting two fingers up to us.
Well, of course, he claims that Egypt's, you know, judiciary is entirely independent.
Of course, comrade.
Uncorruptible, etc. But I did want to ask you, John, as somebody who does have fairly intimate experience of observing and dealing with a regime that often does things which to almost the entirety of the rest of the world seem absolutely bizarre and inexplicable. Is there some logic to this that, well, from an Egyptian, that exists from an Egyptian perspective, or particularly from an Egyptian regime perspective, but to nobody else? Because it is rare that you see a single development as universally condemned as this has been. Not one person has put their hands up and said, actually, I think the Egyptians might have a point here.
If there is any kind of rationale behind the Egyptian move, other than a deliberate attempt to embarrass Kerry, it's invisible to me and, as you say, to almost all other observers. Either this is simply dreadfully incompetent timing, or it is a deliberate attempt to provoke. Neither is clever.
Justin, you know Peter Greste, I believe, slightly. Obviously, what's happened to him is the kind of stuff that haunts the nightmares of any journalist who has worked in any slightly dodgy situation, which I think is one of the reasons that the media has responded so strongly to this. It is just there, but for the grace of God, for pretty much all of us. Is this Egypt, do you think, trying to frighten off foreign media scrutiny, or is this all really about Egypt's feud with Qatar?
Well, I think there is a long-running antagonism between the Egyptian state and Al Jazeera. I think if this was a BBC reporter or a CNN reporter, I suspect it perhaps wouldn't have come down to this, or at least as bad as this. The only other rationale I can see for the ruling is that this may be a very cynical, ruthless marker You don't mess with this. We are back in power. This remains a police state. You can forget anything about media freedom. We will even send foreign journalists behind bars. I think the timing of it, you both referred to a second ago, it was, for me, I thought it was breathtakingly cynical. Within sort of hours of receiving the message from Kerry, okay, boys, you can have your billions back again, and then to slam an entirely innocent foreign journalist behind bars, it was just outrageous.
I just want to ask you both very briefly about the foreign response, particularly from Australia, where, of course, Peter Greste is a citizen, and indeed Canada, one of his co-defendants, is a joint citizen of Canada. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott said he was shocked, dismayed and bewildered. John Everard, is that a weirdly passive choice of language? I, for one, would have preferred something along the lines of absolutely bloody furious.
Well, yes, absolutely. Absolutely Furious would have probably rung a bit more, but the trouble is that Absolutely Furious tends to end up in a trail of dots and an expectation that you then do something about it. Quite what Australia could ever do about the situation is far from clear to me.
Sending in a gunboat from that distance is possibly somewhat impractical. Justin, is there more that, you know, the involved governments could and should be doing?
Well, the hope is that sensible people behind the scenes will be talking to the general and his other minions and say, look, this is not going to work for you. It's completely counterproductive. This is an innocent man. You're doing yourself no favours. You need foreign investment. You certainly need a tourist industry. I think a lot of international visitors who normally flock to Egypt year after year have taken fright, and quite rightly so. It looks ugly. And I would hope that behind the scenes, the generals will, or the General Sisi will come to his senses. The idea that he can't interfere in this, of course, is nonsense, as we intimated earlier.
We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, plus John Everard, the former British diplomat and Monocle regular, and the author and historian Justin Marozzi. When we return, we'll be looking at South Korea and Somalia, countries our guests know well.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take five times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is John Everard, the former British diplomat, and the author and historian Justin Marozzi. Now, the pressures of serving in the demilitarised zone between the two Koreas, it's possibly the most ironically named place on Earth, were emphasised in dreadful circumstances over the past weekend. A South Korean soldier killed five members of his own unit and injured seven others, and was apprehended only after an unsuccessful suicide attempt. John, it's not the first time something like this has happened. South Korea is unusual. I think possibly only it and Israel you could still count as first world countries which conscript people and then send them to something like war.
Yes.
Is it something about that combination of conscription and high pressure which produces incidents like this?
Yes, absolutely. The South Korean military is tough. It has to be. It's guarding one of the most heavily militarized frontiers anywhere in the world against a particularly unpleasant opponent. And the conscription is general. You often get young men from sort of quite gentle South Korean middle-class families put in the most appalling and physically dangerous situations, and every now and then one of them will crack. As you said, this is by no means the first incident of this kind. There was a nasty one back in 2011 where somebody else went on a shooting spree, killed four people, I think it was, on that occasion. And there's been one every sort of couple of years for a while before that. If you put normal civilized people under the kind of pressures of the demilitarized so-called zone between the Koreas, every now and then, this kind of thing is going to happen. Worse, of course, we're seeing this from the South Korean side. It's becoming ever more apparent from North Korean defectors that on the North Korean side of the demilitarized zone, things are a great deal worse. At least South Korean troops get reasonable R&R from time to time, and they actually get to eat rations, a treat often denied their North Korean opposite numbers. And defectors have spoken of people actually opening fire and killing dozens of people on the northern side before they're apprehended. The big break on more of that happening on the North Korean side is that, firstly, the weapons tend not to work, and secondly, the soldiers are not trusted with ammunition in the way that the South Korean soldiers are.
What is the South Korean, despite incidents like that, what is the South Korean attitude to conscription? Is there any sort of sentiment against it, or do people just realise this is something that has to be done and we have to do it?
I think the latter. People bitterly recognise that their country, of course, remains divided. They've got a very difficult and very challenging opponent in the northern side of the peninsula. There is a kind of escape valve that if you come from a reasonably wealthy Seoul family, it's not difficult to pull strings and to arrange for your son to do military service not in the mud and filth of the DMZ, but in the relative comfort of the riot police of Seoul. This leads to a rather strange situation that the supposedly tough riot police, the ones who during the military regime used to go around cracking the heads of demonstrators, are these days full of really rather nice young gentlemen who are every now and then sort of have to face rather rough demonstrators. And I remember one particular incident when I was in Seoul where a member of the riot police went on deployment with a rather fetching Winnie the Pooh pink umbrella that his loving mother had clearly given him just in case he might get wet on duty.
Well, on that happy image, finally, we should take a look at Somalia, because until recently, Justin Marozzi, as well as being the author of a fine new book on Baghdad, was working as an advisor to President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed. I don't know if you saw it, Justin, but today, just today, in fact, President Mohammed has been reported as announcing that Somalia is in a political crisis. It's tempting to ask...
Another one?
You've preempted my question. Is this news?
I suppose based on my recent short-term experience, no, I would say sadly that the country lurches from one to the next. But, in its defence, it should be said that this is not really, I mean, this is as much of a municipal mayoralty as it is a national federal government. It controls a proportion of the territory. Much of Somalia still remains in al-Shabaab hands. Al-Shabaab has managed to suck Kenya into this dreadful insurgency. And there have been recent bombings, I think, by the Kenyan Air Force today, the last 24 hours. I remember Hassan Sheikh saying that, you know, his entire inbox was, you know, crisis after crisis. He's trying to pick up the reins of a country that has known civil war for 23 years. So crisis is the normal for him, really.
Well, I mean, there's always flaws with analogies, but, you know, Somalia has been the poster boy for failed states for the entire modern era. It's the one against which all other failed or failing states are measured. Are there lessons from Iraq and vice versa? We were talking earlier there about the dismemberment of Iraq. At what point, and as you mentioned, 23 years of civil war, anarchy, disorder, at what point do you just give up on a country as an idea and say, look, let's try something else?
Yes. Well, I'm smiling now because I'm just recalling during my time in Mogadishu, it seems sort of every week there would be a new man standing up and declaring himself president of a region that hadn't existed before, or a new state or a mini region. And the one thing that is lacking there, I think much more than in Iraq as a comparison, is a sense of national unity. All Somalis have one religion, they're one language, one people, but the clan system is so deeply rooted that it really does find itself in constant tension with the idea, which is essentially the modern Western nation state on the one hand, Somali clan system on the other, and they're incredibly uncomfortable bedfellows.
And John Everard, we were talking earlier as well about the role of foreign diplomacy in Iraq. In a place that is chaotic, whether it is Iraq, whether it's Somalia, whether it's a place that's either falling to pieces or being put together or one or the other and then one or the other and then both. What is the role of a foreign diplomat on the ground? How constructive can you be?
Well, there aren't that many of them on the ground. There are plenty of them under the ground right now. But the situation in Mogadishu, as Justin just indicated, is pretty rough, and it's extremely difficult to conduct any kind of effective diplomacy. To put it quite simply, at the moment, what is going on in the territory of what used to be Somalia is largely beyond the reach of international diplomacy. And the attempts by the international community to try to improve the situation. As you said, for 23 years now, haven't actually brought very much.
A final question to you on Somalia, Justin, because it's a question I'm always curious about. It's a question I've put myself to a few either recently deposed or would-be leaders of various troublesome or troubled places. Hassan Sheikh Mohamed, why would you want to be president of Somalia?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, President Hassan Sheikh, unlike some other Somali leaders, is not from the diaspora. He's homegrown. He's grown up in Somalia. He grew to a maturity as an adult in Somalia during the civil war, and he was one of the many sort of civic leaders with an academic career as a university dean. If you read, the speeches that he made in the run-up to his campaign and during that time, he was just desperate to try to get Somalia back on its feet. AMISOM, the African Union mission, had managed to dislodge al-Shabaab from Mogadishu, later Kismayo. This has been the greatest moment for Somalia in sort of 23, 24 years. But I think it's really going to take a long time. I think it's unrealistic for any of us to expect one man to suddenly deliver, stability and prosperity. This is a country, as you just said, is the world's worst failed state. It's recovering from that, but there's a huge, huge way to go.
We will have to leave it there. Justin Marozzi, author of Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood. John Everard, former British diplomat, author of Only Beautiful Please. Both fantastic books, incidentally. Thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And plenty still to come in the second half of today's show. Our man in Madrid will run us through the news in Spain, and film director Diego Quemada Diaz will join me to explore the themes of his film The Golden Dream, newly released in the UK. All that and more, but first, Suzanne Chislett has the news headlines.
Thank you, Andrew. The US Secretary of State says regional unity will be key to expel ISIS rebels from Iraq. John Kerry has been meeting with Kurdish leaders and has urged them to back Baghdad as it tries to force Islamist militants out. The Ukrainian government has accused pro-Russian separatists of shooting down an army helicopter. The aircraft was downed near Slavyansk in the east of the country. It's thought all 9 people on board were killed. The Australian government says it will try again to appeal to authorities in Egypt following the 7-year jail sentences given to 3 Al Jazeera journalists. An Australian and 2 Egyptian reporters were found guilty of supporting the now-banned Muslim Brotherhood. They denied the charge. The lawyer of the Sudanese woman who was freed from jail yesterday after refusing to renounce her Christian faith says she's been rearrested. Mariam Yahya Ibrahim, her husband and 2 children were held as they tried to board a plane out of Khartoum. And the British Prime Minister has made a public apology after his former spin doctor was convicted of phone hacking. David Cameron had stood by his press secretary Andy Coulson when the initial claims were made about voicemail interceptions when he edited the News of the World newspaper. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Suzanne. Welcome back to Midori House. You're live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:33, near enough to it, in Moscow, 18:33 in London, 14:33 in Rio. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Earlier, I spoke to our man in Madrid, Liam Aldous. First of all, a tale of two parades, as I understand it. First of all, we should talk about Felipe VI's coronation parade. Not all constituents of Spanish society were entirely welcome.
No, and this has generated a bit of a controversy because there was allegedly an order given to police to prevent people with Republican flags to attend the ceremony. And while the government spokesperson, the government delegation in Madrid, has denied that this order actually took place, there's actually footage of police denying access of people wearing Republican flags and even wearing little brooches with with the Republican colours. So there's this amazing image of this woman, this girl, who's actually just going to visit her sister on the other side of Gran Via and wasn't allowed to actually go through. And a lot of people were quite angry. Police even entered buildings to ask people to take down flags from their balconies. And the government spokesman, like I said, has come out and said, no, there was never an order. Police did this on their own initiative, which is actually leaving the police out in the cold, because it actually seems like we've got some renegade policemen, people who are staunch monarchists, which is probably not the case.
For the uninitiated, what does the Spanish Republican flag look like? Is there one banner under which all of Spain's anti-monarchists gather?
Yes, it's the flag from the Republic, the Second Republic, which was in the 1930s, and it's red, yellow, and purple. So it's quite distinctive.
So not dissimilar from the actual Spanish flag, just with a bit of purple in it.
Yeah, and without the royal insignia. So, I mean, this obviously it's taken the shine off of the coronation, because the debate on all the kind of weekend television shows over the weekend was about this incident and wasn't about talking about the new prospects for the monarchy. So I think the government's plan to reduce conflict, potential conflict, as they said, actually backfired and just took the focus off of the king. But then I'll get onto the second parade. The second parade is another colourfully flagged parade, which will be in about a week and a half. It's the Madrid's Gay Pride event, which usually goes down Gran Via. But for the second year running, the mayor and the government, the national government delegation in Madrid have reached an agreement to prevent it from going down Gran Via, and it will be down another street. And this has angered a lot of people.
Is there any particular reason given for this?
They say that it's actually to prevent or allow emergency services to cross the city. They say that it clogs up the city, but people are saying just a week ago the king's coronation ceremony went down Gran Via and the whole city was shut down. There was metal detectors installed on the street and people couldn't even cross the street at certain times to go to their houses. So it seems like there's one rule for kings and a whole other set of rules for queens.
I see what you did there. What is the general attitude of Madrid to its Gay Pride parade? Does anybody really strenuously object to it at this point?
No, no one apparently except the very conservative, Catholic inclined people in the government. The city is embraces the parade. It's actually one of the second biggest in the world after Sao Paulo's Gay Pride, and you see families out there waving. I've seen people in hijabs out there waving. Everyone's it's just a huge party. It gets really out of control. And last year, when they actually didn't allow it to go down Gran Via, people didn't care and actually were out on the street anyway, and there was cars going down the street, and it was actually quite dangerous. So we'll see what happens this year. It's just a ridiculous decision, if you ask me.
So we'll move along to another story you've pointed out, which suggests that anybody who wants to parade through Madrid for any reason isn't going to be doing it on shared bicycles.
Well, there's a few people out there, but you're obviously talking about the Madrid's new bike sharing scheme, which is electric. It's the first electric scheme to be rolled out in a capital city in Europe. And it was inaugurated yesterday, and there were some amazing images of the mayor, who doesn't get out into the public very often, riding a bike and all these bemused people looking in a shocked way at their almost invisible mayor out on the street. But there's been some huge teething problems and hiccups. The computer system crashed, and a lot of people are already complaining that it's been kind of rolled out in a very rushed way before the elections. Even though they've been talking about it for over a decade, it seems to have been rushed out, and there's some inevitable teething problems. And the pricing structure is also a big point of criticism.
For those who've actually managed to ride the bicycles, what are they like?
Well, they're nice. They're nice and white. They're not contaminated, if you will, with advertising, which is another sticking point, because there's no publicity or advertising agreement to advertise on the bikes, which means that the buck is being passed on to the consumer. It's the only bike sharing scheme in Spain. I'm not sure about Europe, but where the users have to pay on top of their annual quota are 50 cents for the first half an hour. So most of the bike schemes, they're free for the first half hour, but Madrid, where the users are paying for it, and they could have obviously gotten a lot of money if they actually organized a company to sponsor the bikes.
And we should move along finally to a new or putative new political force in Spain, which is receiving a rather warm welcome from Spain's media, as I understand it.
Not at all. Yeah, exactly. It's Pablo Iglesias from the Podemos party, which the We Can party, which received a huge showing in the European elections.
He's not an Iglesias of the Iglesiases, is he?
No, but he does have a ponytail. So anyway, it's a left-wing party, and like you said, the media has predictably launched into this kind of character assassination campaign, probably spurred on by some of the other major political forces in the country. And one of the main headlines going around in the last week is that the Podemos members of the Podemos party received about 3.7 million euros from Hugo Chavez's regime, which sounds like makes a good headline, but when you actually get to the bottom of it, they were part of a consultancy which received 3.7 million euros over the course of 10 years, and there was about three people or three or four members of this consultancy. So it's a bit of money, but it sounds a little less less strong or less controversial when you see it spread over 10 years.
The Podemos party, are there other left-wing populist movements in Europe that they're comparable to? Maybe something like Five Star in Italy?
Yeah, I mean, they're probably, depending on who you talk to, but they're probably less populist. They're saying a lot of things that a lot of people are thinking, and obviously the major political parties aren't saying or doing. So you could compare them that way. But they've also they've organized a lot of ground support, a lot of grassroots support in a lot of villages and stuff. And it has come from the mass protest movement, the Indignado protest movement in Spain, which was from 2011. So you could compare them, but obviously they have a very Spanish edge, and we'll see how this media campaign to really attack them and discredit them will fare for the party when the municipal elections and regional elections take place next year.
And that was Liam Aldous, Monocle's man in Madrid. Up next, we'll be meeting the director of acclaimed Mexican film, The Golden Dream.
From coat hooks to ceramics, cooking utensils to kettles, satisfying solutions are to be found in Monocle's roundup of simply designed and endlessly useful things.
When Lee Stewart and Kailash Parmar met in London, they set out to design the Crash Bang Wallop hanging shelves. Inspired by suspended kitchen utensils, the design stems from the idea of framing the objects within the shelf.
Objects of Desire, a slideshow featuring Monocle's top 25 home helpers, now showing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1841 in London. Now, there is no starker delineation between third world and first than the border which separates the United States from Central America. As such, that frontier is an irresistible pull for artists, authors, songwriters and filmmakers looking for a backdrop for meditations on immigration, ambition and the relationship between the have and the have not. The latest of these is Diego Quemada Diaz's debut feature, The Golden Dream, which won 8 awards at Mexico's Film Awards, the Arioles, including Best Film and the A Certain Regard Prize at Cannes. We have a clip from the trailer.
Siento como si tuviera un zoológico en mi estómago, como si un montón de animales estuvieran corriendo por todo mi cuerpo de la emoción que vamos a ir al otro lado. Yo siento que todo lo que miremos allá va a estar así bien tuanido. Todo va a salir bien y vamos a llegar hasta donde queremos.
Buenas, chavos.
Osvaldo. Samuel. Juan.
Ya no quiero viajar ya con ese indio.
Nos vamos a ir los tres, ¿entendiste, verdad? Los tres. Así que te aguantas.
And not only do we have a clip from The Golden Dream, we also have the director of The Golden Dream, Diego Quemada Diaz, who joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Andrew. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Immigration across the Rio Grande is obviously an absolutely enormous story, which you've chosen to tell by telling a small story of just three would-be immigrants. How did you go about, developing and defining those particular characters?
Well, the original inspiration actually for this film was a British film called In This World by Michael Winterbottom, and which follows
a similar trail from Afghanistan via Pakistan to Europe.
Yes, to London, and so originally I wanted to make a docu-fiction, just like he did, you know, based on a one-page synopsis, just find the kids and follow them. But I was just not able to find the money. You know, everybody was like, well, you know, you're not Michael Winterbottom, so you gotta have a script. So what I did is I focused on listening to the migrants for over 7 years in different locations, you know, in Guatemala, in Mexico, and in the United States, in prisons, in deportation centers, in the border, northern border, southern border. And from those testimonies, I constructed the narrative and the characters. So I tried to take the best from fiction, you know, and the best from documentary. So, you know, with fiction, you're able to construct the characters, to create a dramatic arc that expresses your idea, the idea that you want to express, and to articulate it, you know, through actions, through conflicts, through character development, through a powerful ending. And then in the way we filmed it, we always inserted our non-professional actors into this journey. You know, we filmed it with a method that I learned from Ken Loach, and they just had an experience, and we were observers witnessing this transformation that took place in them. I would insert them in the realities of those towns, the factories, the real trains with the real migrants. So the film is a powerful document. And a powerful story of this epic, no? Because it's a contemporary story, but at the same time, it's a universal story. You know, it's a journey within the migration context, but at the same time, it's the inner journey of a hero that wants to realize his dreams, and is the same story in a way that it's been told before, in the sense of it's a human being trying to realize his dreams and what is a learning from this journey. And there's a lot to learn from these extreme situations.
How important was it to you to use non-professional actors? Was that also a borrowing from In This World?
Well, there's a lot of films that, like I love Italian neorealism, and I love also a lot of the free cinema in England. And I wanted to work with mostly non-actors, just to give them voice, to also talk about migration as an economic issue, no? to find our protagonists in the most impoverished areas in Central America and Mexico, and to give them voice, you know, and they bring so much into the characters that you would never dream of. So, as a writer, you construct the characters from the research, from the details you find in the research, and the narrative, but also from, they bring you a lot, you know. So you do a long period of a workshop before you shoot, and you observe them, and you're constantly learning from them.
I wanted to ask about the research you did. You spoke to many hundreds of people who had direct experience of immigration, and immigration from south to north is usually presented as a fairly straightforward tale of ambition for economic advancement, and perfectly fair enough. But in the amount of interviews you did you find anything that surprised you? Did people tell you things you weren't expecting to hear?
Yes, and that's exactly the counterpoint of the film, is this the whole thing with the snow, because suddenly I you know, everybody was talking about the material dream, like you're saying.
Yeah.
And I found that there was an internal image, how they imagined this idealized place, right? And they all talked about the material things, the skyscrapers, you know, the beautiful parks, everything is clean, and there's a lot of work, there are big plasma TVs, there are trucks, there are beautiful women, they're like, God knows, well. And suddenly one of them told me, I just want to see the snow. You know, I just want to see the snow falling, because where I am from, it's very hot. And over there, I hear it's very cold. And there's white things fall from the sky. And I remembered, you know, when I first saw the ocean, you know, like, or when I first saw the snow, it's this very innocent dream that we all have inside of us, that we all have, a little children, a little kid that, you know, that. So I wanted to connect with that. With that original dream, and this that we all share, and to create a clash between the indigenous cosmology, you know, represented by this more poetic way of looking at life, and the Western model, you know, symbolized by this mixed race Guatemalan who's very white, and the other kid very brown. So there's also a racial conflict, which I think it's also behind this migration conflict. There is a clash of civilizations or a clash of ways of looking at the world. No, so I wanted to through this conflict of races, of languages, of cultures, to talk about what unites us, you know, as human beings.
You mentioned there a while ago that you had worked for and with Ken Loach on several of his films. How much of an influence has he been on this, your debut feature?
Well, it was a huge influence to me, Ken Loach, as well as Barry Ackroyd, his cameraman, and as well as Chris Menges, you know, his cameraman prior to that, and Brian Provin also, who was the cameraman before that. So the whole style of the BBC documentaries, 60mm, you know, very this fantastic style that was created here in England. So I took many things. I mean, my experience when I worked on Land and Freedom back in 1994 as a clapper loader, it just marked me for the rest of my life. I mean, I was so enthusiastic about it, so happy, and also I had seen all his movies at the time and I admired him, and basically I applied his method of the formal simplicity, you know, like the form doesn't stand out by itself, you have something to say, you're making films not only to entertain, but you also want to have a social function, you know, that as a mirror, though collectively we can look at ourselves, and you hope that it's going to have a positive impact, you know? You give voice to people that don't have normally voice, and you film it also in this style that the actors don't know the story, so you don't reveal them the script. You every day before shooting I will read them the scene for 5 minutes before shooting, I would tell this that we wrote here, how would you say it to your friend? And then I would rewrite the dialogues right there. And then, so they live an experience, a life experience, instead of acting. And then you film it in a way where you're always at their eye level, no? You're always as a witness. It's almost like the camera is another character there. And the viewer is an observer of this experience. And that was basically everything that he taught me. And this invisible direction, like he always said, the best direction is invisible. You know, it's indirect. You worry about the context, creating the context that provokes their behavior, but you never tell them how to do it. You allow them to be themselves. And then a lot of the focus is on the casting, because that's the key, really.
That's The Golden Dream. It's out this week. That was its director, Diego Camarda Diaz. Many thanks for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, this is Monocle 24.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is
Londres. Hollanda.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We've reached that point of the programme where we review the best, occasionally the worst, of the arts. Today we're talking music, world music at that, and I'm joined now by the music and photography critic Sue Steward, though we will just be sticking to music today. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be back.
First, well, you've bought three tracks for us to listen to, at least some of. Introduce the first, if you would.
Yeah, the first one is called Bijiga Setenta, which is, and the album's called Occupy.
Glad you said that. I was about to call them Bixiga 7.
Well, Bijiga is part of São Paulo. It's a really gorgeous area, and it's a sort of bohemian area. And this is where the Band of Ten set up there. They're all professional musicians, and they set up this big sort of orchestrated band, which is, I call them the sort of Brazilian bohemians with beards, because all these young guys in Brazil have beards nowadays.
How unusual! There is a global beard crisis of some sort or another. We can listen to some of that. This is Brazilians with Beards.
Thank you.
That was Bashiga 7 there with Occupy, or from the album Occupy, rather, the track there, Kalimba. That's the first choice of today's music critic, Sue Stewart. We are hearing a lot of Brazilian music, mostly in, you know, cues for ad breaks in World Cup coverage.
Yeah.
Is it terrifically representative, do you think? Or is there a whole bunch of Brazilian music we're missing out on?
There's a massive bunch of it. The interesting thing about Brazil is it's actually a continent. And within that continent, there are so many places where you've got different rhythms and instruments. So if you piece it together, you really get a rhythm of Europe in the same sort of way. What you're hearing here is the fusion that's going on between the traditional Brazilian music of sambas and the forró, which is the one that's playing a lot in Rio at the moment, which is a kind of real dance close-up thing. And this is what's happening, is that the fusion is going with back to African and the Afro-Brazilian music. This track we've just listened to is very Congolese. It's those guitars which are very sort of rhythmic and moving and like water flowing. And it's the suku style. But then there's also influence coming in from jazz and Ethiopian music. So it's becoming a real, real great mixture of stuff that's happening a lot in the kind of, it's sort of left field, but it's actually very popular within all aspects of Brazil, particularly around Rio and São Paulo.
Okay. Well, if you could introduce the second track you've chosen today.
The second track is from Sonido Gallo Negro, which is actually means a black rooster crowing, and the sound of him crowing. And this track is Serenata Guajira.
Sonido Gallo Negro, if I pronounce that correctly, with Serenata Guajira. I really like that. That had rather a whiff of, and I mean this as a compliment, sort of 1960s game show theme about it.
Well, you know, it's got a Hammond organ in there, and I think it really does it.
It was the Hammond organ that gave it away.
Yes.
But it's not a 1960s game show theme.
It is not, actually. No, it's very much today, and it's another of those fusion things. This band is really interesting. They're from Mexico City. They perform in monk's outfits, so they've all got the sort of dark brown hoods on.
It gets better and better.
And it's kind of mystical. Sendero Místico is the name of the album, and it's Mystical Path. And it's got a sort of mystical element to it, but it's very, very psychedelic. And the sleeve note looks like a 1960s Beatle record, or sort of that era of Bob Dylan's sleeves.
So basically it all sounds like space-age 1960s game show themes played by men dressed as monks.
But very, very interesting and complex music at the same time.
Yeah, you had me at men dressed as monks. They're my new favourite band in the world. So we've learned something today. This is excellent. Your third and final selection for this evening is Nina Miranda, I believe I'm right in saying.
This is true. We're going back to Brazil. And we're ending with this because it's the launch day today of Nina Miranda's track called Futebol. You could say football if you like.
I'll say football.
Call it futebol, sim, call it futebol, não. Call it futebol, yes, call it futebol, não. Call it futebol. Call it futebol.
Nina Miranda there with Futebol, the third and final selection of today's guest music critic, Sue Stewart. Sue, just finally and briefly, if you could, with another few weeks of being bombarded with Brazilian imagery and sounds, is there, say, one other particular Brazilian artist you think people should be looking at if they were going to look at one?
Current today?
Ideally, yeah.
I tell you what I would suggest, and it's Giles Peterson, the genius DJ and record producer, who's got a new compilation out, and it's a really great list of current contemporary dance music from Brazil that he's worked together with.
Sue Stewart, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our early special guests, John Everard and Justin Marozzi. The show was produced by Alan John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Johan Lau, sorry, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Section D with Tom Morris is next after the headlines. I'll be back with Emma Nelson for the Daily at 2200 and indeed back with this show at 1800 tomorrow, London time, you lucky people. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.